WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Sevilla Mann. For 5 years, the Hidden Kalamazoo Tour offered a different take on the history of the city's downtown. It took people to storage areas, to basements and old apartments. They weren't traditional historic sites, but they offered clues about how life has changed over the last 150 years. As more and more buildings redevelop downtown, the future of the tour is in question. But you'll soon be able to visit all of those sites anytime in the Hidden Kalamazoo book. To learn more, we're joined by City of Kalamazoo Historic Preservation Coordinator Sharon Ferraro, as well as Historic Preservation Commission member Regina Gorham and former member Tony Halowinski. As an extra, we'll learn about a project to protect aging gravestones at the Mountain Home Cemetery and the do's and don'ts of headstone cleaning. Welcome all to West Southwest.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's start with where. Where are you taking people who sign up for the Hidden Kalamazoo Tour?
This year, nowhere. We would love to still be doing it, but when we started doing the tour, there were a lot of empty spaces downtown, especially the upstairs. And because of the development that's going on down there now, we just don't have those spaces anymore. There's two spaces we haven't seen. One has an unsafe staircase, and the other one has no staircase to the second floor. And we feel it would be inappropriate to take people on tops of the roof of a building and up a ladder to go on a tour.
Do you? I mean, a tour like this anyway.
You know, it would be fun, but I think that the liability people might be really concerned about that. So we decided that this year, rather than do a tour, we planned we were going to do a book. We're going to tell people about all these buildings they've seen, the new things we've discovered about the buildings. And I want to make it really clear, none of these buildings are coming down. The reason we can't look at them again is because they're now, you know, rooms, offices, their apartments, their all sorts of other different things, so they're no longer vacant, which is wonderful. That's what we wanted, but it's harder to get into a tour when it's someone's apartment.
I guess that's probably true. Regina, Tony, anything to add?
It's not so much an anniversary edition of a book, so much as it is kind of highlighting these spaces that look markedly differently now than they used to. There are a couple here and there that are still undeveloped, basically, and are still used as storage, more or less, by the companies and businesses that own them. But it's a little slice of history of the building in the present, kind of, that is gone.
When you were doing the tour, where were you going? Are these buildings that everybody in Kalamazoo knows the name of? Are they ones you've never heard of? Or is it a little bit of both?
Well, there's the State Theater, which I'm sure everybody has seen at least once, I'm hoping, or been inside. That's kind of the crown jewel of the downtown. We went through 27 different buildings, usually vacant upper floors. Sometimes it was ground floor. Most of the time it was a vacant upper floor. Sometimes it was a building that had already been totally rehabilitated, such as the building that Bronson uses for Bronson Healthcare Group, what we call the Upjohn World Headquarters building on John Street. So we had some buildings that were completely redone, and we had some where we actually literally had to cover holes in the floor and put cones around it so people wouldn't go through, but we still wanted to get a chance to look at these floors, these empty spaces. And the idea was to stimulate people's imagination so that they could look at it and say, oh, this is really kind of cool up here. You know, it's kind of a mess right now, but maybe it would be cleaned up. I think my favorite year was the year that we did the vacant space above what was then Alfred E. Bike, okay, next to Bimbo's. And then the same year we did the space above Food Dance. And those are very similar spaces in the fact that they have a central staircase, they had rooms around the central atrium, they had a giant skylight in the roof. One of them, above Alfred E. Bike, was before nothing had been done to it, other than they were storing bicycles up there. But then the one above Food Dance had been completely redone so people could see the before and the after. And I really loved having that contrast so that people could imagine what it could be like.
And as a footnote, they are redoing the space above Alfred.
It's almost done.
It's almost done into condos. So,
yep, it's going to be really, really nice.
Great.
Back in the 1990s, early 2000s, 90% of our upper floor spaces in Kalamazoo, in downtown Kalamazoo, were empty. Or they were storage. There was, you know, the Fraternal Order of Police had a meeting room, clubhouse up, you know, above one of them, that kind of thing. But now it's like almost the reverse. I think I counted up very carefully the other day, there are 11 upstairs spaces in downtown Kalamazoo that have not yet been redone. And that's it. That's why we're building new. That was part of what the tour was getting at, get a chance to see them before they're gone because they're redeveloped, but also to get people to have the imagination to say, this could be an asset. This is something very nice. This could work out really well.
With so much visible history on the surface in Kalamazoo, the exteriors, just walking around one of the historic neighborhoods of the downtown, you get a sense of the development of Kalamazoo, how it's changed over time. I'm still wondering, what is it exactly that makes it worth the effort to sign up for the tour and to go through all these spaces and, you know, avoid those holes in the floor that you've carefully marked and everything like that? You know, what is it that makes it worth the effort in those spaces to see them?
You walk past these buildings sometimes day after day, and you look up and you're like, oh, I wonder what's inside there. And we give you that eagle-eye view of what's inside this building. And we sometimes help dispel the myths about a building.
I mean, there have been people that have been sneaking into some of these buildings, the urban explorers, that are very proud of the fact that they get in and they do a YouTube video and put their face right in front of it and wonder, how did they ever find me? But so this allows you to be the urban explorer completely legally with a guide, knowing that there's not going to be something you're going to step through the floor and kill yourself. So it kind of satisfies that curiosity. And that's the really fun part. It's like, And it's fascinating because when we were doing the tours, we kept getting information back from people saying, well, I've heard that, like, there's tunnels connecting these buildings, and that one of them was that there was an old army truck parked in a passageway under Lovell Street. And I thought, I don't think so. But you get these weird stories that pop up, and it's just a lot of fun to try to figure out where it came from and maybe to dispel that myth and give people the straight information. No, Elvis did not live here. Yeah.
Two spaces that you maybe don't get to explore as much in historical context are interiors and then also uncurated spaces. That's what always struck me reading about Hidden Kalamazoo. You're not taking people to a space where, you know, you've set up somebody's bed like it was in the 19th century with their dresser next to it. It's a little more raw than that, but it sounds like there's something to be discovered in that.
Oh, yeah. One of my running jokes with the folks that own Heemster Optical, who have been wonderfully supportive of this whole thing, is that every time they get new equipment for their optical company, they'd move the old stuff upstairs. So it's like the 20th century optical equipment museum up there. Mm-hmm. Totally uncurated, though. It's like all random pieces around here. And it's absolutely fascinating just to go up there and see what there is. Because that space is probably unused since around World War I, except for storage. So you're right. It's an uncurated space. What's here? What used to be here? What can the building itself tell us? I mean, when we go into above the Coney Island, for example, this is a little tiny detail, but...
And for people who don't know the Coney Island...
The Coney Island building, it's the four-story at 262 to 266 East Michigan. The Coney Island has been there forever. But anyway, there was two different ways that you would put plaster on a wall. One is you'd put the trim up first on the floor, and then you'd put the plaster down to the trim. And the other is you'd put the plaster all the way down, then you put the trim over it. And that's one of the ways you can date a building or when it was done by that little tiny detail. And in that building, you can see that. Okay? And in other buildings, you would have to, like, well, I don't know, maybe make a hole in the wall to see that. And that would be inappropriate generally. So we've had a lot of fun pointing out details. How did people ventilate buildings in the 19th century, in the early 20th century, when we didn't have air conditioning? How did transoms work? Why were there skylights on all these buildings? How did people rent a room? Why aren't there kitchens in all these apartments? Because if you have like three-story buildings in a row, that means any rooms on the side of the building aren't going to have any natural light. All they're going to have, and so, for example, above Pedals and Postings, which is on the Mall, it's in the old Fuller Theater building, there are little skylights, maybe foot and a half square, in each room that doesn't have a window to the front or the back. And so that lets a little bit of air in. It also, you could open it and it would let warm air out. Okay, and then over the central atrium, there was a huge skylight. And then all the rooms that faced the central atrium where the staircase came up also had windows in them with frosted glass in. So you could get the light from the skylight in your room on the side of the building. You could get the air because you could open the upper window or you could open your skylight and the air could come in and you could get fresh air that way. But this was all before air conditioning, all before furnaces. People were probably heating with small stoves because you actually, back then, you took your stove with you from place to place that you lived. And then you would buy your own coal and you just hook it up to the hole in the chimney, in the flue. So, I mean, it was a different way of living. And you didn't necessarily live above the business you worked in. There's lots of cases we found where a little restaurant is here, but the people who are running the restaurant live four doors up above another building. And quite often, people didn't have kitchens. They might cook a little bit on the top of their little heating stove, you know, maybe a little frying pan where you see in the Old West movie, someone's just frying up a sausage and some potatoes and just flipping it over in there on top of the stove, and that's fine. But that's the way people would do it. Or they would go to the all-you-can-eat buffet at the bar. They'd buy a beer, and they'd get everything they wanted to eat that was all super salted so that they were really thirsty, and they would drink lots of beer because they were eating all this super salty food, but it was free. So people, they kind of, if you live downtown, you live differently than the way we do today. Although, personally, if I lived downtown, I'd want to live above a restaurant and just put a little dumbwaiter in. Just, you know, just send my order down, and the food would come up to my kitchen.
Not everybody had a kitchen.
No, not everybody had a kitchen. In fact, we found, I think in all the upper floor buildings that we looked at, I think we found one, maybe two kitchens, or the remnants of a kitchen. You know, there are no appliances in it, but you'd see, you know, that it was set up to be a kitchen, that kind of thing. So it's just because they didn't. You would rent a room, or you might rent two rooms, and they would just usually be sleeping rooms, and there would be a shared bathroom down the hall, and shared tub. The tub was in a separate room. Okay, that had its own lock on it, so you could go and use the toilet, or you could wash up, and then you could use the tub. And that was all down the hall. Same thing, the Coney Island building was originally a hotel, and all the facilities were at the back of there, and everybody shared it. Every room had a sink, but if you wanted to use a toilet or to take a bath, you had to go to the back of the building and take turns.
One of the cool things is when you're looking at a building and you're trying to date it, look at something as minute as wallpaper. And there are cases where you can go layer to layer and say, oh, well, this was put up in the like the 40s. And then you go back and you can see the different patterns. And I think we've gone all the way back to the 1800s. I mean, you know, there's definitely, and Sally from Douglas and Son is a fanatic for wallpaper. And she helped on the tour a couple of years and was ecstatic to see all this old wallpaper.
Yeah, in fact, on my computer at work, I have this whole file that's just wallpaper for Sally, so that whenever I see old wallpaper that's been revealed, whether it's in a house or an old downtown building, I just send it to her, and she can usually come fairly close with dating it, and she can even tell me frequently someone is replicating this wallpaper and making it again now, or something similar. So it's just, it's absolutely fascinating, and that's why the logo for the Hidden Kalamazoo tour is the door and the peeling wallpaper.
I don't know if I have a favorite thing, but there is a different feeling to being in a historic building than when you're in a modern building. And I don't know if everybody feels that when they walk into a space like that. I know that I do, and everybody who works on the tour does too, and everybody who goes on the tour, I feel like, are of the same mind. But when you're literally walking into a space that is as is, like in the Coney Island specifically, you're walking into a space that people walked into every day 150 years ago to go home to their room or to leave to go to work. And you're walking those same steps and you're walking that same space. And we do the tour during the summer. So last year I was in Coney Island when it was like 95 degrees outside. So you can literally feel what it was like to be in there without air conditioning, with a couple of windows popped open, hoping that the breeze would hit you while you're standing there waiting for your next tour group. So it's that feeling of being in those spaces that no one can recreate today. It's not possible. Nobody can do it. And they're very, very special and unique in that way.
It's a temporary permanence is what it feels like. You walk into a building that you know has been there 100+ years, and you just feel the security, the safety, the heft of the building. It's likely survived the tornado that went through, and it's still there. It's going to be there probably longer than we are.
Heemstra Optical, Sharon, I think maybe you said there's something missing in there, and it's a clue.
Well, when we were doing the tour, I couldn't figure out at first because they've got some of the most ancient wiring for electrical fixtures that I've ever seen. It's like bare wires with little wooden clips that hold them in place on the walls, and it's really probably some of the first generation of wiring that ever went into Kalamazoo. But then went up there, I thought this is. And I finally realized what was missing was there's no water upstairs. There's no toilet facilities up there, which is why I say I'm like 95% sure that this was not living space and has not been used for anything but storage since around World War I. because getting about that time, people were saying, you know, I at least need a toilet down the hall. Mm-hmm. And there was just nothing there. There's just nothing up there. And it's 1, 2, 3, 8 rooms, I think. And there's just no water facilities of any kind up there.
But once upon a time, maybe before World War I, there would have been people living up there?
There would have been, yeah. Very possibly were people living up there. There were offices. That was where I think someone who was one of the early paper manufacturers had his office. Yeah. And the facilities would have been chamber pots and an outhouse out back. Mm-hmm. Or a place you could dump your material in the basement or something like that. But it wasn't. There was not a, what we think of today as an absolute necessity, which is a toilet of some kind. It just wasn't there. There's a dumbwaiter there, though, and I still haven't figured that out yet. There's a dumbwaiter shaft, what mm-hmm. that was for.
They put that in but didn't have plumbing.
Well, it might have been if it was storage for the sporting goods store that was downstairs, I could see where it might make life easier to put things up and down in a dumbwaiter than run up and down the stairs. That's all I can think of, because it was a sporting goods store for quite a while, too.
Is it all in the downtown?
It's all in the downtown, and we plan it to be walkable.
This is West Southwest. We're speaking with City of Kalamazoo Historic Preservation Coordinator Sharon Ferraro, as well as Historic Preservation Commission member Regina Gorham and former member Tony Helowinski. They're working on a book about little-known but revealing historical spaces in downtown Kalamazoo, which were highlighted on the Hidden Kalamazoo Tour. What's the most contemporary site you do right now, or did when you were running the tour?
That'd be like the youngest building.
One. Yeah. The baby
probably
building.
The Civic and City Hall would have been the youngest ones.
And even those have been around
those are from
for a
the
little
30s.
While.
The early 30s.
Those are the babies.
Well, I'd come to think of it, too, the Tall Bank building, what's now the Fifth Third, used to be the American National.
Mm-hmm.
That's about the same time as well. Those are all from the early 1930s.
Yeah.
So, but we haven't done any modern buildings yet, because quite often, well, it's not as fun. You know, going into the old spaces, seeing a basement room that's still littered with stuff, I mean, that's really fascinating. Being above Terrapin, where it used to be the Montgomery Wards, used to be the Walgreens on the ground floor, and now it's, you know, Terrapin and another place. But upstairs, it was just like this was the Montgomery Wards. These were, you could see still how the walls had been decorated to be a department store. And the big freight elevator at the back corner and the room that they used for alterations, those were all still there. The customer restrooms were still in place. You know, so it was really kind of neat to imagine that. And again, see what was it like here. And the top floor was just storage, so it was, you know, in workspace. So that was kind of fun to be up there too. And like Regina said, it was just fun to see, well, what's happening. And we've been into basements too, not just upper floors, because basements are fascinating spaces, absolutely fascinating spaces. So how do you get like light into a basement? You know, it's 1890. You have this building you've just put up and part of your design has to be somehow. How do you get light into the basement? Last summer when they were tearing down or they were opening up to build the Exchange Building, the new 15-story that's going up, everybody got very excited because the excavation revealed this row of windows underground. And they thought, whoa, what was this? Was there a secret passageway under the street? What was this? There's this windows underground. Well, what they
like
would,
that army truck that's under
Well, right, exactly. It's under Lovell Street, exactly. But what they were was to get light and air into your basement, what you would do is you would have like a window well that was usually about maybe as little as a foot deep. And then as wide as the window, but maybe even more than that, there'd be a little rail around it or a grill over the top. But it was literally a window underground to let air and light into those downstairs spaces, those basement spaces. So, yeah, they were windows, but they didn't lead to everybody said, oh, it's got to be a secret passageway. That was a door that led to a secret passageway under the sidewalk. No. But there are vaults under the sidewalk, like at the PNC Bank, which is now the Peregrine Building on the corner of the mall and Michigan Avenue, the white one, the vault is literally under the sidewalk. The basement vault is under the sidewalk.
Is it still used?
No. It's open. I don't know whether the new owner has the combination. It might be tricky to close it because it could be very expensive to get it opened again. But it's still there and it's complete. You know, it's really kind of cool. Because when they put vaults in, you had to get this amazingly heavy thing underground. And unless you planned to put it in before you even started construction of the building and it could get in the way of that, it was easier to put it under the sidewalk because then you could get it in later. And they would excavate a hole that was big enough, and then they would design the hole in such a way and fill it with sand, put the vault on top of it on a platform, and then they would slowly take the sand out and the vault would slowly settle down into the basement where it needed to be.
What's the strangest space you've taken people into, or the one with the most spiders? Different ways to approach that question.
There's spiders everywhere and birds that have gotten in through broken windows.
Yes, I have a series of photos I've taken that I call it the dead birds of downtown Kalamazoo, because I find them in a lot of the old buildings, some skeletonized, some still have feathers on. Mm-hmm. Every so often, one of them is flattened. I found one in a parking lot the other day that was just totally flat. It's like, poor thing. But anyway,
I think above A1
printing. That third floor was, the windows were blown out in the tornado, so it had a little bit of trouble. It hasn't been used except for a little bit of storage for probably since A1 moved in the 1980s.
And which street is this?
A1, that's on Michigan Avenue. It's right next to, almost next to the subway and to that modern building that's right down there with the glass elevator. It's right next to that, because the A1 printing building. And that third floor had 5 rooms in it. The wallpaper was peeling. That was the one that had the hole in the floor that we had to put a board over and little cones around it and say, do not step, do not step here, that kind of thing. It was sound. It was just that there was this hole where there used to be a vent, a big air vent that came up there, and it just had, the vent had come out and had never been replaced, and so it was just a hole. You could fall very easily. That was probably the most, maybe abandoned is the right word, inactive use. A lot of the other ones you could see that, you know, people had, like above Heemstra, they'd taken the equipment up there. They had a couple of light bulbs, and you could see their Christmas decorations were up there, you know, mm-hmm. so you knew it was used. The Fuller Building, which is above Pendleton Postings, that again had all sorts of storage up there, and they were so kind as to move all their storage stuff into one room so that we could tour the other 9 rooms up there. So that was probably the strangest. Now, there's been some I've been in that have been stranger than that, but they weren't part of the tour because there was not a way to make them safe enough.
Do you sign a waiver?
No. What it does say, though, I think on the ticket, it says by buying this ticket, you agree that you will abide by the rules of the tour. So, yeah, exactly. And the saddest thing to me was that there's no way we could make all these sites barrier-free. In many cases, that's the reason the site hasn't been developed, is because there's no way to get an elevator to it or something like that. And so I really felt sad that we couldn't get more people there. But that's why the spaces are empty, is because they are not barrier-free. So there were some that were fine, like the State Theater. You can see pretty much almost all of it, ground floor anyway, without an elevator. And, of course, the Upjohn World Headquarters building, no problem. The Food Dance building, no problem. The ones that have been done were easy to get around in. But the ones in Park Trades, they have an elevator. That was the weird thing. Park Trades.
I was just going to say, the safe.
The vault in the basement of Park Trades. That was fun. When I first toured that with the folks from Plaza Corp, who were kind enough to let us use it, I said, well, then there's this vault here. And I said, have you ever gotten it open? And they say, no, we think we have the combination because someone had written it, left it in the file upstairs when they bought the building.
This is the big former industrial building on Kalamazoo Avenue.
Yeah,
that's
where the old artist
studios
are.
Now.
Yep, mm-hmm. yep. And it's just, it's a wonderful, wonderful building. I love the freight elevator too, but there was this vault in the basement. And that's the difference. A vault is built in and a safe you can move. So
yeah,
this is a vault.
Built in.
So this is definitely built in. It's about the size of, okay, this may date me as well, a phone booth.
Oh, so it's not terribly big.
Not huge. No. Not huge. Not like the one over at the bank under the sidewalk, no, which is small.
That's
hotel room size.
Huge,
you know, it's really big. This is a small one, but they couldn't get it open. And then after the tour was over, one of the folks from Plaza Corp started playing with the numbers, and she made a list of what the possible uses of those numbers could be and how they could be done. And she actually hit it, I think she said, on the 4th or 5th one. But I can't say what they found inside.
You can't?
Mm-mm.
It was not Al Capone's.
No, it was.
No, it was nothing related.
About
to
as far from unexpected as, or from what you expected as possible. It's like I never would have imagined that.
It wasn't a body. It wasn't a fortune.
No,
nothing criminal. Nothing shady. Nope.
Not just, Elvis. Not the army truck.
No.
No Jimmy Hoffa.
Not a entry to a tunnel to somewhere else.
No army truck. But very, very, yeah, no truck.
No army truck.
But it was really unexpected. But, I mean, there's that kind of thing. And actually, several of the buildings had safes in. And I learned, because I helped do the research, that actually there are very experienced safe crackers that you can hire that will come and do it for you legally. You have to prove you own the building, and then they will open it for you, if they can. So, and the FBI doesn't do that for you. Somebody told me, oh, I got a hold of the FBI and they wouldn't help me. Of course they're not going to help you. The FBI. It's not their job.
You'd have to tell them you thought there was something shady in the
right, yeah, maybe.
Safe for the vault. Yeah, maybe yeah. Then they'd, yeah. Yeah, maybe then they'd come. But then when right, it turned out there wasn't, they might be annoyed. So you're working on a book version of Hidden Kalamazoo. And so is the book pretty much meant to be the tour on paper? Are you doing all the same sites? Is it like more sites even?
We're covering the same sites. There is going to be a little bit more information in that. We're explaining some of those things like Sharon talked about. So what is a transom window? Why were there skylights in the center? Why are all the rooms faced towards the center? Those sorts of things that are stuff that we probably would have talked about on the tour. Plus, we are adding more as a group of nerdy researchers who love looking things up. Many of us, I will include myself in it, went down rabbit holes of researching, finding the names of the people that lived in the apartments, finding, you know, that they had an office up there and did sewing on the side, you know, out of their apartment and that sort of thing. So really bringing to light a few more stories that maybe we didn't know about during the tour. And a lot of the tour, of course, is using the space itself as things to point at, which is a little harder to do in a book when you're not actually in the space. So really kind of bringing out more of those unknown stories or lesser known stories up to this point. So that kind of shapes a lot of the chapters and the stories about the buildings.
And we're sticking to the buildings that were on the tour. We're adding, well, sometimes you need to talk about the building next door to talk about this building. So there's that kind of thing. But so we haven't added any more buildings. We've added general information. And then there's a very short chapter on the tornado because that was a huge, huge thing in Kalamazoo.
The tornado in 1980, mm-hmm. it went through the downtown, mm-hmm. went right down mm-hmm. Michigan
right, almost,
Avenue.
Pretty much right down Michigan Avenue. Mm-hmm. Yep. Only lost a couple of buildings completely in the downtown, which was surprising. And it ripped off some of the metal facades, which was, in the long run, kind of a good thing. So
we're not too mad about it.
Well, the owners were, but yes, yeah. We're good with that. But, so we're covering the same. We hope to have the book out. We don't know for sure, but we hope to have the book out in time for Christmas season this year.
You're working on the book now. You're not doing the tour, the Hidden Kalamazoo tour, this year. Might the tour return in the future?
Depends on an awful lot of different things. Partly finding it. Finding places to go that we haven't already seen, because the first year we did the tour, very successful. The second year was not as good because we reused some of the spaces. So we know that people, you know, maybe if it's long enough, they'll be happy to go and look at the spaces again. And we've also been toying with the idea of possibly moving out into a neighborhood, like maybe out into Vine or into the Stewart neighborhood or something like that, because it would still be Hidden Kalamazoo. It just wouldn't necessarily be the downtown. But we haven't really gotten into discussions about that yet. We want to get the book out because all of us are dreamers. And we come up with these wonderful ideas of things that we could do. And then we have to say, no, wait a minute, we can't do everything. How much can we actually do? So we're kind of trying to hold off on dreaming about next year. But we do have our website is still up, hiddenkalamazoo.org. It is .org.
Oh, you're looking at me.
Yeah, I don't
I didn't
remember.
Set it up.
Anyway, we do have a website for Hidden Kalamazoo, and we have a Facebook page. So if you follow either one of those, especially the Facebook page, you can stay up to date on everything we're doing.
As a kind of historical bonus here, Sharon, I hear that you are working on a project at Mountain Home Cemetery. Do you want to explain about that?
Yes, we are doing working with the city for the cemetery.
City of Kalamazoo.
The City of Kalamazoo mm-hmm. Cemetery. Yep, we are working with the folks at Public Works who handle the cemetery. And every time I go there, it's like someone's tipped over a gravestone or it's just deteriorated and tipped over all by itself. There's
a little bit of tornado.
1855? Mm-hmm. You know, very, very old. It's the oldest active cemetery in the city. Pioneer Cemetery Park, down on Westnage near Wheaton, is older, but it's not an active cemetery anymore. Has not been since the 1860s. About the time, actually, that one closed down was when Mountain Home opened up. So Mountain Home is absolutely beautiful, and we were kind of distressed about what was happening. And we wanted a project that, like the Hidden Kalamazoo tour, although even one step up from that, Hidden Kalamazoo, you pay to be part of it. And what we were hoping to do with the cemetery was to create greater respect for the cemetery itself so people would speak up when they saw other people doing something wrong in the cemetery. And then also that we could engage people. They could come in and they could help us take care of the cemetery. And so we decided that what we wanted to do is an inventory and evaluation of the condition of the gravestones. So last May, we did Section 15, which is down by Forbes Street. And it didn't take anywhere as long as we thought. And it was all done on paper this time because we're just kind of test running it. We've had an offer now of some couple people that are willing to write a program for us so we could do it on smartphones and integrate the photographs we take directly into the database. And so that's what we're doing. Now, the group is called the Grave Issues Squad.
Very serious.
Yes, well, it is. Yes. And it's just, it's very, and
grave,
respectful. We wanted to be respectful. We came up with a lot of very funny names that we did not use because we wanted to be respectful of it. But it is. These are important issues, but it's also a little bit of a play on words. And so this summer, and we have not yet set a date, it's probably going to be late summer into September, we want to go into a section of the cemetery and clean the gravestones. And that, again, will be an opportunity for people to become involved and to come out there and help. We're looking at a couple different products to do that, that do not cause damage, but that also can inhibit further mold and moss growth and that kind of thing. So we're hoping to do that. That'll be sometime in September. Don't know exactly yet when that's going to be. Part of that's going to be weather dependent. Mm-hmm. And then we're just going to just clean them up. And so while we're waiting for the program to be written, then next year we'll start doing inventorying the other sections of the cemetery. And in the long run, we hope to end up with a really comprehensive report. And then we can start planning for what needs to be done to repair the gravestones. What permissions do we need to get? Because grave sites are actually the property of the family. So do we need to get permission to do something? And we're going to aim at the majority of the gravestones. We've got some beautiful ones. We've got angels. We've got a couple of obelisks that just toppled over, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. If we're going to be spending money on this kind of thing or time and effort, we're going to do as many of the smaller ones as we can rather than necessarily pay attention to the really big ones because the big ones are just a totally different engineering issue. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we just want to get it cleaned up and a little bit more welcoming because it's a beautiful, beautiful place to go any time of the year. It's just gorgeous in there. And maybe in the long run, even going out to Riverside too.
Is Riverside in a little better shape?
It's about the same. It's not as urban. It's not right in the middle of the city as much. So I think there are fewer toppled gravestones. But in terms of just general, not deterioration so much, it's just we don't do cemeteries here like a lot of folks do in the South where they go out and they tend the grave every Memorial Day. Some people do that, but it's not. We don't have as well-tended graves. And we want to go out and just see what we can do. And it's such simple work that it's an opportunity for people to engage with history with little risk, give us a little bit of their time, and actually make a difference.
With what you're asking about whether or not Riverside is worse, they're both fighting against the fact that they were built on hills, which mm-hmm. was a very common thing that they started creating cemeteries to make it more park-like because they were the first parks. They were seen as these environments that you could get away from the city, you could get away from being downtown, and you could go picnic. That's not really how we really view spaces like that now. Like Sharon said, you know, Mountain Home is still active, so people are still burying their family members there. So it is very much kind of a
solemn,
yeah, or, you know, kind of a contemplative place, yes. Potentially. But we're also in the cleaning and the inventory, we're not just looking at the condition, we're also writing down information. So in terms of genealogical history, we're trying to make sure that people aren't lost because we can't stop the effect of time. We can't stop the fact that people's names are starting to be rubbed off of the stones on the front. But what we can do is try and make sure that we have their name written down now so that somebody in 100 years could still go back to our records and go, oh, this is actually my great-great-great-grandfather. So it's that combo, and it's really capturing all that information and then educating people about how they can safely maybe tend to their family's gravestones if they know where they are. There's so much in the differences between the materials used that you really have to be careful about when you're looking at gravestones. Not everything's granite.
Right, we got granite, marble. There's some metal ones, you know, and you treat each one differently. But I can say if anybody out there is going to go and clean up a family gravestone, do not use anything like bleach or vinegar. Just don't. And no metal brushes, only natural bristle or plastic. Mm-hmm. Please. But there's ways to do it that are even easier. And we're hoping to educate people because we've had Boy Scouts say we would like to do a project or, you know, Girl Scouts or a club. We'd like to do a project, but something the kids can do. And this is something that using the right material that kids can do. So it's a way to engage them so that they are more, they understand the cemetery more and that they are interested in it and want to take care of it.
If you have to get permission from family members to interact with the graves and even to clean them in some cases, how far out do you have to go to try to find a living relative?
Well, we don't necessarily have to, okay? I mean, in the sense, but if there was a big piece that was damaged and we wanted to repair it, we would very much do everything we could to try to find that family, unless whatever was happening with the monument was actively dangerous.
Okay. Yeah, if it was
going to fall on someone.
And that would be a liability issue that would be outside of the hands of the grave issues squad. We wouldn't even be talking about that. That would be someone else's responsibility. But for most of what I'm not sure exactly what we're going to do. I don't think we need to have individual permission to clean, as long as it's something that is not in any way going to change or damage the stone, which is why we're doing very careful research. And there are two or three products that are easily available that are like that. You can, you know, that you can just stick your hand in them. They're not going to do you any damage. They're just a specific combination of detergents and microbicides that keep new things from growing. So, yeah, and we're looking forward to doing that. And some you don't even need to scrub. You just need to spray it on, and then the rain will wash it away. As the enzymes break down the soil and the dirt and the mold and stuff that's on the grave, it'll just wash away. So it won't be clean right away. You don't have to scrub it, which can sometimes be problematic because you could be scrubbing off the last little detail on that name. So this way it just would clean it and maybe make it more visible and easier to read.
We've talked about the Hidden Kalamazoo Tour, which is becoming the Hidden Kalamazoo book, and the Grave Issues Squad. Is there anything you'd like to add before we wrap up?
I've got two interesting things. And one is the Preservation Commission is also going to offer a set of old house owners workshops. This summer, we're launching our Facebook page next week, so you can go to Old House Owners Workshops, O-H-O-W, O-How. Like, oh, how do I do that? There's going to be three this summer. And we're also, starting in the fall, October 1st, we're going to do a new citywide historic resource survey. We are going to look at all 22,000 buildings in the city. Kind of like we're doing the inventory of the gravestones, going to be an inventory of all the buildings in the city, so that we have this database of all the buildings, and then we can look at where the historic sites are.
Well, Sharon Ferraro, Regina Gorham, and Tony Halowinski, thanks so much for your time today.
You're welcome.
Sharon Ferraro is the City of Kalamazoo Historic Preservation Coordinator. We also heard from Historic Preservation Commission member Regina Gorham and former member Tony Halowinski. They are working on a book version of the Hidden Kalamazoo Tour, which they hope to finish by the end of the year. You can subscribe to WMUK's West Southwest podcast on Apple iTunes and by searching podcasts in Google Music. This is West Southwest. I'm Sevilla Mann.